Welcome, everyone. Coast to Coast AM. I'm your guest host, George Knapp, and let's get right to it. Our guest tonight is, I think you're going to like him. Joseph Farrell was born in South Dakota, earned a PhD from the University of Oxford in 1987, has an interest in utilizing modern science to interpret ancient texts and esoteric traditions, has written three books. We're going to be focusing on one of them. It's called The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And this is a guy with a lot of interests that cover a lot of ground, philosophy, religion, music, science, history, all of which he thinks need to be rewritten. Joseph, you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me on, George.
Absolutely. Can't wait to talk about this book. Could you, for the benefit of our listeners, sort of give a nutshell summary of what the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, the main thesis is, and then we'll tackle it one piece at a time?
Sure. It's basically a book concerning what the Nazis classified as their most secret black projects, secret weapons project during World War II, and that project was called the Bell. And basically, this project, once we get into it, I think your listeners will understand, this project involved a physics of such extreme sophistication, particularly for its day, that it literally gave them the power or the control, really, of energies and forces that would make ultimately a hydrogen bomb look like a kitchen match. So it's a very big topic, and it really only began to come to light after German reunification.
Okay, well, let's start with what the Bell is, and sure. Let's start with this way. Who worked on it, and how did you find out about it?
Well, that's an interesting story. Let's kind of put it into a little context here. Most of this information that is in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell really started to surface after German reunification, and that's really a signal historical event, because what it did was it kicked loose a lot of classified documents in American archives and also in Eastern European archives. And one of the things that occurred as a result of this was that some of these archival information became known to a Polish researcher by the name of Igor Witkowski, who really is the fellow that uncovered the story of the Bell that Nick Cook and I have written about subsequently. So it goes back to German reunification and some of these things. But the other aspect of the story is, as you mentioned, the personnel that worked on this thing, because it was not something that the Nazis sidelined to second stringers. The man in charge of this project was none other than Walter Gerlach. And some of your listeners may even know who that was. Walter Gerlach was a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. He was internationally known. And his specialty was in things like magnetic spin resonance, gravitation, and so on and so forth. So he was the one that headed up this project, but there were a lot of others. But this is the one that's really kind of important for our story for the moment, because it signals the fact that the Bell involved physics that was related to the control of gravity.
Well, tell me this, as we go down this path here. You mentioned Witkowski finding these documents. How compelling is the paper trail? What's in the documents that led you to be interested in the Bell?
Well, the paper trail is interesting, but I think we have to stress here that the story of the Bell is not just based on a paper trail of things that Witkowski was told and that he uncovered. The story is also corroborated by the installations that were found in Eastern Europe, the old Soviet zone of East Germany, and then, of course, in Poland. A lot of these installations were just completely unknown until Witkowski actually uncovered them. But the actual paper trail itself goes back to the affidavit. It's a war crimes affidavit of a four-star SS general by the name of Jakob Sporenberg, who was tried after the war in a Polish war crimes court. And this is kind of interesting, because this SS general was actually tasked with the murder of 60 of the scientists that were working on the Bell as the war drew towards its close. So in other words, the SS was extremely interested in preserving the knowledge of this device and its science to themselves. They were interested in keeping it out of Russian hands and Allied hands, I believe. But in any case, Jakob Sporenberg, in his war crimes affidavit, spells out some of the operating effects of this device. He spells out some of its features, its dimensions, where it was tested, and so on. And we can get into that as the evening goes. But that essentially is the paper trail. But I want to stress that there's more evidence involved in the paper trail and the installations themselves. It's kind of a story that you have to piece together very slowly and piece by piece.
I know you do that in the book and meticulously, and you do some of that on your website. A lot of your stuff, you're sort of connecting the dots. I mean, there is a certain amount of speculation involved in this,
sure,
right?
Absolutely.
And have you caught a lot of grief in that regard from either historians or ufologists or all of the above?
Well, not so much grief from historians and ufologists. The book actually is kind of a mystery even to me because it's one of those books I don't really promote that much, but it continues to sell. I've had people emailing me, the usual anonymous contacts claiming they're the usual connections in the military-industrial complex, telling me that it's kind of kicking up a quiet little stir in that community, but, you know, I have no way of verifying whether that's true or not. But I really haven't caught any grief from anyone yet, and I think largely it's due to the fact that I do try and document everything that I say rather meticulously in terms of my physics speculations of what I think they were doing with this device.
Well, Coast to Coast has a real big audience, so maybe we can stir up some grief for you and send it your way.
Sure.
I noticed that you also, in your book, you cite other books that have been written sort of on related topics, not directly related, and you draw inferences from those works. For example, books about the German atomic bomb program, right?
Right, absolutely. And again, this goes back to the fact that after German reunification, so much archival information, just because of that event, was kicked loose. So some of the things that were picked up on very quickly by German researchers was the fact that there was a rather strong circumstantial case to be made that the Nazis actually tested some sort of nuclear device fully 8 months prior to the end of the war, so that, you know, that would be several months ahead of the Manhattan Project and our Trinity test. And a lot of this information kind of dovetails into the Bell story because part of the Bell, I believe, involves the use of radioactive material. So it's a rather big story once we get into it, and it's a rather important one.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to hear what you think this bell can do, because I know a lot of there is speculation that maybe a lot of what we see as UFOs might be related to this technology. We'll be right back with Joseph Farrell and the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your guest host, George Knapp, broadcasting live from Las Vegas. Our guest tonight, Joseph Farrell, the author of the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. Joseph, why don't you just tell us, what is the Bell? What were the Nazi scientists trying to find when they were working on this thing? A new plane, a time machine, a bomb, what?
Well, let's describe it first, and then we can get into some of what I think the science was that they were after. The Bell itself was a device that was bell-shaped, and hence that's why the Germans codenamed it Die Glocke, or the Bell. It stood approximately 15 to 18 feet tall, and about 12 to 15 feet wide. It was covered or encased in a kind of a ceramic metal casing. And inside this device, they had two counter-rotating hollow drums into which they poured a serum that was codenamed Serum 525 in this Polish war crimes affidavit. Now, the serum itself was described as being kind of a reddish-violet in hue, and it was kind of a gooey, jelly-like liquid. So I suspect that it was some isotope of mercury that perhaps had been doped with other radioactive materials like thorium or barium or something like that. Once inside these two counter-rotating drums, they then sped them at extremely high speeds in opposite directions. Now, during its operation, it had to be tested inside of a ceramic brick room, and then the walls of that room were also lined with rubber mats. So in other words, this thing gave off extreme field effects that we'll also talk about once we get into this. Now, I believe what they were trying to do with these counter-rotating drums was cancel out or zero vector the forces, magnetic forces, and create a kind of a bubble around the device. And what they were really trying to do, and again, this is kind of going back to Dr. Walter Gerlach and what his specialty was, I believe what they were trying to do was create a kind of a space bubble or space-time bubble around this device and learn how to manipulate the very fabric of space and time itself. Now, once we've said that, that implies that what they're really after is both a device that can be used for propulsion purposes, for some sort of anti-gravity effect, as well as a weapon. And I stress the weapon aspect of this in distinction from Nick Cook or Igor Vitkovsky themselves, because once you have control or the ability to manipulate those kind of forces, then you have the potential for a weapon that can make really a hydrogen bomb look like a kitchen match, which I said before. So the Nazis were playing around with some real doomsday physics here.
How close were they?
I believe all indicators from this affidavit and from other research, I believe that they were extremely close. And again, part of that is based on the fact that the SS itself took such extreme cautions to make sure that this technology and the knowledge of it did not fall into Nazi hands, or pardon me, into Allied hands or Russian hands after the war. And it's really only because of this declassified war crimes affidavit that the story broke at all. And once the installations themselves were discovered, then you kind of put two and two together that they were extremely close. I should stress that one of the installations in this respect is a large concrete structure above ground that looks almost like Stonehenge. It's some sort of test rig for something, and the Polish concentration camp workers that were actually involved as slave laborers for this project state in some of their testimony that at night they would see barrel-like objects ascending above the tree line with kind of a bluish glow around it and then float back down. So in other words, they're describing something that could be the bell itself. It's very similar. So I think the Nazis were extremely close.
Is there anything in the affidavit of the SS general that refers to, like, firing it up for a test flight or something like that?
No, but it's interesting that you mention that, because the tests themselves of this device are some of the clues that we have to reconstructing what the physics may have been. When the bell was first tested, it actually killed seven of the scientists involved. So in other words, it achieved some sort of probably nonlinear effect that the scientists were not expecting. Subsequently, the Germans tested all sorts of living matter, plants, animals, and so on in the presence of this device. And one of the peculiar things about those tests were that the plants that they exposed to the bell began to decay literally within a matter of hours into kind of a blackish-gray goo. So in other words, the bell, if we measure the effect that it had on plants, the bell was in a way kind of speeding up time. So in other words, again, that's a signal or a signature of something that would be wildly successful in the manipulation of gravity, because if you manipulate gravity, you're manipulating time. The animals and humans that were exposed to the field effects of this device, their cells began to decay, and decay rather quickly, so that, again, you had a breakdown of the body metabolism, and some of the effects were quite lasting in some of the people exposed to it. They would experience vertigo, sleeplessness, and so on and so forth. So it was a very toxic device.
Could this have been, in essence, a practical time machine where you can go forward or backward?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's kind of a complicated answer. I'm actually writing a sequel to the SS Brotherhood of the Bell right now. It's at my publisher, and I've uncovered some more information. But the long answer is I don't think it was a time travel device per se, although I think that some of its effects were, as I indicated, to speed up the metabolism and the decomposition of organic material that was exposed to it. So, yes, it was manipulating time effects, but I don't think this is really what the Germans were after. I think that they were after some sort of field propulsion device and ultimately after a weapon based on the ability to manipulate the fabric of space-time.
You mentioned this ceramic brick room and and the tests that were conducted there and the Polish prisoners of war who had seen different kinds of weird stuff in the sky. Right. That brick room really exists, doesn't it? It exists now?
Yes, it does. All of these installations where the bell was tested were in a little German town in Lower Silesia. And for your listeners that don't know where Lower Silesia is, if you look on a map of Germany prior to the war, there's a little arm or finger that sticks down in between Poland and Czechoslovakia. That would be Silesia. It's in modern-day Poland now. But this little town was called Ludwigsdorf. The Polish name of the town now is Ludwikowice. There is, in this town, an old mine called the Wenceslas Mine, which the SS took over and converted into the underground installations to test this device. And then close to this mine, there is this hinge-like structure that looks like Stonehenge that I mentioned before. And there's also another thing that I should mention that's a very signal clue into some of the physics that's probably involved. And that is, the Germans built an entire power plant, an electrical power plant, right there in those installations. Now, to my mind, that's a significant clue because it may indicate that they were requiring high voltage direct current electricity beyond the ability of capacitors or batteries, banks of batteries to provide. So, again, they were experimenting with some very, very avant-garde notions in physics.
Was there anything else, any other kind of program that was underway at the facilities you mentioned? You know, for example, you mentioned these 60 scientists that were killed by the SS to keep the information out of the hands of the Allies. Was there anything else that they were working on at those same facilities that might have been an interest to us? For example, any of these guys working on the Bell, working on the A-bomb, anything like that?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, Gerlach himself, the man that was in charge of the Bell project, was also, by 1944, the entire Third Reich's atomic research head. So, in other words, there is some sort of connection between the Bell and their atomic bomb program. Now, as for other projects in the area, the only one that I know of, George, that's in that area is a large German underground bunker complex that was probably intended as a field headquarters for Hitler and some of the command staff of the Third Reich. That facility was codenamed Riese, and it's very close to these other facilities. But I don't know of any other secret weapons project in that area other than at Auschwitz, and I should stress something about Auschwitz here. The German chemical combine IG Farben, which everybody is probably familiar with, built a huge, gigantic synthetic rubber plant at Auschwitz. Interestingly enough, at the end of the war, the directors of IG Farben in the war crimes trials kept insisting that this huge synthetic rubber plant never produced 1 ounce of synthetic rubber in the entire 4 years that it was in operation. Now, that plant consumed more electricity than the entire city of Berlin, which at that time is the world's eighth largest city. So in other words, the signature, the footprint of this plant is not at all that of a synthetic rubber plant, but it is the signature of a large uranium enrichment facility. So yes, there are lots of very covert things going on in that area.
And did the IG Farben guys, did they talk about what was really going on inside their plant, or they just said what wasn't going on?
They just basically said what wasn't going on, but I think they probably did so with a little tongue-in-cheek, realizing that eventually somebody would get a clue as to what probably was going on there, and that was probably uranium enrichment. There's really only that technology that is in existence at that time that would require that heavy amount of electrical usage.
Back to the discussion of a paper trail, you mentioned the affidavit of this SS general. Anything in the document area, like diagrams or manuals, that sort of point out how this thing could work or could be built, or was all that paperwork destroyed?
That's an excellent question. All that paperwork is destroyed. There's nothing beyond his descriptions of the actual physical shell of the device and some of the effects that it had. But in terms of
I'll tell you what, Joseph, if you hold on a second, we're going to have to take a break, and we'll allow you to answer that question when we come back. Speaking with Dr. Joseph Farrell, I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone, to Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. I'll be joining you the third Sunday of each month. That's the plan the folks at Coast to Coast and the producers have in mind. I just heard the promo during the break for tomorrow night's show. Dr. Jacques Vallée, I think you might have heard me in previous appearances here say that, in my humble opinion, that Dr. Vallée is the most important person to ever jump into the UFO field. He's written some fascinating books. I know his take on the whole phenomena doesn't mesh too well with the theories espoused by other ufologists, but I think he's the most important thinker in the field. And as you probably know, a couple of years ago, probably more than 10 years ago, Dr. Vallée just decided to walk away from ufology, tired of all the infighting and bickering and turf wars and nutcases, and felt that there was nothing left for him to learn. So I don't know how George Norrie did this. I don't know what he did to get Jacques Vallée to come on the show, but I know that I'll be listening tomorrow. And congrats to George, and I'm really jealous about the whole thing. Tonight, we've got a heck of a show ourselves. We're talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell, the author of The Brotherhood, the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, about this secret research that dates back to Nazi Germany. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to pick up the questioning where we broke off and also find out what happened to the Bell and did it, in fact, get incorporated into American programs. So we'll be right back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, your host for this evening. My guest is Joseph Farrell, the author of The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And before the break, we were talking about whether or not there's a paper trail, including any diagrams or manuals about how to build one of these things. Joseph, can you pick it back up and tell us whether such writings exist?
Sure can. And in fact, we can kind of answer both questions as to what may have happened to it after the war in dealing with the first subject, because a very peculiar thing happened to the Bell at the end of the war. It went completely missing in 1945, along with all of its project documentation, and along with the SS general that was in charge of all of the Third Reich's secret weapons projects, and I mean every last scrap of them, they all disappeared, along with a gigantic six-engined Junkers 390 aircraft. Now, for listeners who've never seen one of these, I do have a picture of it in SS Brotherhood of the Bell. It's a gigantic aircraft. It was intended for ultra-long-range heavy-lift flight. This aircraft was capable of flying from Nazi Germany to Argentina nonstop. So it's an enormous craft, and all of these things go completely missing at the end of the war. So there is no paper trail of manuals, diagrams, or equations or anything like that. But I should mention that Walter Gerlach, the man that was in charge of this project, was one of the 10 scientists that the British interred at Farm Hall to record their conversations about the state of German atomic bomb research. And interestingly enough, Walter Gerlach was the only scientist of all of these 10 that we brought over to this country for further interrogations after the war. And his diaries are classified to this day. When he returned to Germany, he never returned to the subject of gravity or magnetic spin resonance again. So in other words, if we look at that circumstantial evidence, it would seem to point that the Bell ended up in this country. However, there is a British researcher by the name of Jeffrey Brooks who's uncovered information and documents in Argentina that indicate that the Bell may have gone there and disappeared into some independent post-war Nazi research project. So in other words, nobody really knows where this technology went, where it is, and how far it's been developed since the war.
You wrote in the book that the general who was sort of in charge of this thing, this Hans Kammler, he disappeared as well. I guess the official version is that he died in Czechoslovakia or something like that, right?
Well, yeah, but there's a problem there, George, because this General Kammler died four different times under different circumstances. So in other words, the likelihood is that General Kammler himself managed to escape all sorts of prosecution at the end of the war, because there's another thing we have to know about this general. Not only was he in charge of all of the Third Reich's secret weapons projects, but he was also in charge of the SS Buildings and Works Department. So in other words, he could tap into literally a slave labor pool of approximately 14 million people to pull off all of these secret weapons projects, and certainly a war criminal. But he, again, goes completely missing at the end of the war. No one knows where he ended up. So it's a huge, huge story.
Do you think it's possible we squirreled him away somewhere like the Operation Paperclip Scientist, but only on a much more classified or secret level, like a witness protection program or something for Nazis?
Oh, sure. I think that's an eminently plausible scenario. And in fact, in the sequel to the book that is at the publisher now, I have uncovered some information, additional information from the National Archives, that indicate that even as late as 1946, the United States was conducting secret covert operations in Czechoslovakia, trying to uncover documents. And it's my guess or my belief that it's somehow tied to the disappearance of General Kammler and perhaps even to the disappearance of the Bell. So it is a very likely possibility that he would have ended up in some very, very covert black project in this country after the war. And I want to mention some other scientists in this regard, too. There was a scientist by the name of Dr. Kurt Davis, who ended up as a director of the Kennedy Space Flight Center in Florida during the Apollo Moon project. I have a picture of him standing next to Dr. von Braun during that era. But Dr. Davis is an interesting fellow because he's not even a rocket scientist, and he is a scientist. He is the scientist, I should say, who designed the entire power plant for the Bell device. So in other words, what is this man doing in that position inside of NASA, in that position of authority and responsibility as an administrator? He'd, of course, have his finger in almost every pie that there was in the Apollo program. So again, you know, if we have that scientist going into America's post-war projects, then again, it would tend to corroborate the idea that Kammler may have ended up here as well.
Any indication that Operation Paperclip, which has been really well documented, that some of the guys, that any of these assorted people with information on the Bell or worked on the Bell, and maybe even this guy, were brought over under the aegis of Paperclip?
Well, I think that there is a possibility, and one of the things, and that's such a good question, because one of the things I discovered is that the United States apparently tried its best to reconstruct as much of the technical team that worked on the Bell as possible. After the war, we were looking, for example, for a doctor by the name of Jenkins, I believe it was, but the name escapes me right now, but we were trying to reconstruct the scientific team that worked on this device. So in other words, I think in terms of answering your question, I think it's very likely that that would be the case.
Okay, so let's assume for the sake of our conversation here, the Bell and some of these personnel were brought over here. Then what happened to it?
Well, if it ended up in this country, it would have had to have been classified at the very highest and deepest levels. I think it probably would have gone so deep that it would have been perhaps even higher classification than the hydrogen bomb and some of our nuclear secrets. Because, again, the physics that was involved here was a physics that was potentially capable of manipulating the fabric of space-time. And when you weaponize that kind of physics, again, you're going to have a weapon that potentially would make a hydrogen bomb look like a kitchen match. So if it ended up here, it would have gone very, very, very deep. It would have ended up at some place like Area 51 or down at Kirtland in New Mexico or someplace like that.
What's the possibility that it was, you know, as we've heard many times over the years in discussing the UFO topic, that if, in fact, there is recovered alien technology tested at Area 51, whatever, that it would have been handed off potentially to private interests as a further buffer from prying eyes like mine, that maybe some multinational corporation would be in control of it now?
Well, as you know, in SS Brotherhood of the Bell, I reproduce a lot of the Magic 12 documents, the so-called Cooper-Cantwheel documents, and then analyze them. And one of the documents in that series of documents actually makes that very suggestion or that very claim that around 1968 or 69, President Nixon actually devolved all private and covert ufology projects into corporate hands. So again, as a means or a layer of extra security, that would be very likely. So I don't disagree with you there at all.
Let's talk about the UFO connection.
Sure.
If, in fact, we have this stuff and it works.
Right.
I mean, your premise is that a lot of what we see as UFOs and that people sometimes think of as ET craft
right.
might be the bell.
Well, I do believe, you know, let's put it back in the context of some other things concerning the end of the war again. Most of your listeners will be familiar with the fact that there has always been a kind of persistent Nazi flying saucer legend or mythos out there. And if you trace that legend back, it always ends up in a very, very few people, and most of those people have some sort of neo-Nazi connection. And it's never been, to my satisfaction, documented too well. But with the Bell, we have a device whose footprints in history are now clearly visible. And as a result of that, I think that we can probably say that the Bell is indeed the basis for some of that Nazi flying saucer mythology. So it may be that what we're seeing in the skies with many UFO sightings, certainly not all of them, but with some of them, would be a development or a continuation of that technology. But again, as I say, the real question is, did that technology end up here or did it remain in Nazi hands after the war? We really don't know.
Well, the Bell doesn't look like a flying saucer,
right.
so is your suggestion that if, in fact, the technology has been mastered, that we put it into other sleeker-looking craft?
It could possibly very well have been that, yes. Again, the Bell represents a kind of a prototypical technology. It was a device that they were using to test various avenues or various aspects of this physics. So, yes, it would have had to have been sleeked up a bit and tweaked.
But there's at least one famous UFO case that does look like your Bell, right? The Kexburg case.
Right, right. Well, I get into that in Reich of the Black Sun, which is the book that's written prior to SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and then kind of pick up on it again in SS Brotherhood. And when I first made that connection, I just was really kind of dumbfounded because the Kexburg acorn, the thing that crashed in Pennsylvania in 1965, has so many connections to the Nazi Bell on any number of data points. It's described as being in almost the same dimensions. It's described as being almost exactly the same shape. And more importantly, it is described as making a similar sound, a kind of a hissing, buzzing, cracking sound that would indicate, to my mind, a lot of high-voltage electrostatics going on. So, yeah, there's any number of connections to it. And more importantly, when the Kexburg acorn allegedly ends up at Wright-Patterson Air Base, it had to be housed in a room with ceramic brick. So, you know, even to the point of the housing of the Kexburg acorn, we're dealing with a data point that connects directly to the Nazi Bell. So I find it rather interesting.
I guess you have to ask, what the heck were they doing with it? If the Kexburg object that crashed out there was the Bell, what the heck were they doing with it, and shouldn't they have been more careful with it?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and just to speculate a little bit on it, when we look at the map that tracked the course of the Kexburg acorn, it comes down out of Canada and then takes a sharp turn over Ohio and then ends up eventually in the crash field in Pennsylvania. Now, it's interesting to me because there have always been these little post-war allegations that the Nazis had set up some secret bases and test sites and so on in the Canadian Arctic. So it is possible that the Nazis may have tested this thing and it got loose from them again somehow, and our military showed up and picked it up. And I find it very interesting that our military showed up at Kexburg so quickly after the device crashes. It's almost as if they had been expecting it or wrested control away from it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So you believe the MJ-12 documents in general are legit?
Well, that's another good question. I don't really get into questions of authenticity in the two books, and the reason why is that I'm more concerned with examining the internal evidence of the documents themselves and the technology that they describe. And what I kind of conclude in Reich of the Black Sun and then later in SS Brotherhood of the Bell is that the technology that the documents describe is not to my way of thinking and my way of approaching the science aspect of it, that the technology is not sophisticated or exotic enough to be... Hello?
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 Yes?
Hello?
I can hear you. I'm not sure if I can hear Joseph Farrell. Is that you, Joseph?
Hello?
I think we're having some technical difficulties here, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm not sure how we can fix them. Our guest, Joseph Farrell, I think we've lost him. All right, we're going to take a short break. We're going to take a break and see what we can do to get Joseph Farrell back here. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast. All right, well... The Joseph Farrell, when he comes back, and I hope we'll get him back, wants to establish that there was a relationship between the Nazi Bell Project and Operation Paperclip. We've been speculating on whether or not the technology that he's describing could be confused with a lot of what we see today as UFOs. And I know a lot of this is speculative, that the book in particular draws lines between a lot of seemingly disassociated events. But if you've been listening very closely, Dr. Farrell is making a pretty compelling case by tracing the paper trail dating back to this affidavit from the prisoner of war, this affidavit of SS general who was in charge of the program, indicating that and a man named Igor Witkowski is the one who dug up these documents after the unification of Germany, to indicate that this was a real project, that many of the scientists who were working on it were murdered by the SS toward the end of the war to keep it out of American and Russian hands, and that if in fact we developed this technology or stole it from them or acquired it in some way, that perhaps it had been incorporated into America's space program, into military research, and perhaps even after that passed on to the hands of multinational corporations, which is what many people believe happened to UFO technology, recovered ET technology, such as from Roswell and other alleged crashed incidents. Are we going to get back Joseph Farrell? Joseph, I don't know exactly where we were when you when we lost you there, but please continue.
Well, I think we were going in the direction of the MJ-12 documents and the kind of evidence that I was talking about. To my mind, does not the technical and scientific descriptions don't really merit an exotic enough science to be extraterrestrial. If we look at the Magic 12 documents, the part that would seem to point to an extraterrestrial possibility is concerning the biology. And all of that in the documents is blacked out. So on the basis of the extant evidence internal to the documents themselves, I think we have to look to a terrestrial origin. And the only place that I think has an exotic enough science or physics or technology at that time period would be Nazi Germany.
There's one interesting thing that you mentioned in the book about these code names for the project that hints about what its true purpose was. You remember those terms?
Oh, yes. One of the code names for the Bell Project was Das Laternenträger Projekt, and that translates as the Lantern Bearer Project. And one of the interesting observations of Igor Witkowski, the Polish researcher that's done a lot of work on the Bell, is that he observes that could also mean light bearer or be a kind of a code name for Lucifer.
Wasn't there also a term that dealt with time?
Oh, yes. It was also called the Kronos Project, and that, of course, is from the Greek word for time, or also Saturn.
All right. We're glad to have Joseph Farrell back with us. You don't know how glad we are, Joseph, and we're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back, and we'll be getting into the idea of whether there's a connection to the JFK assassination to all of this. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, and my guest is Dr. Joseph Farrell, and he's just blowing our minds here in discussing his book, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. Joseph, before we leave the Nazi part of our discussion, there's something in your book where you mentioned scalar weapons. described as monstrous weapons on a daily basis. And, you know, I didn't realize it until I read your book that I'd seen other references to that, specifically in some discussions of zero-point energy. But could you tell us briefly what scalar weapons are, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and whether or not the Bell constituted one of them?
Well, scalar weapons are essentially weapons that are based on or that tap into, like you correctly pointed out, the zero-point energy. It's a rather long and involved technical description, and I get into some of that in the book. But again, basically, it's one way of analyzing the physics behind the Bell. In the new book that's at the printer right now, I analyze it from a slightly different perspective. It basically amounts to the same thing, that we're dealing with a physics that's tinkering with the very fabric of space and time itself and the energy that's involved in it, which of course is enormous. But it's basically a kind of physics that was around prior to general relativity, and Tom Bearden and Nick Cook and some other people have written on these things as well.
The description of it being monstrous, is that monstrous in its potential or monstrous in how it was applied?
I believe both. I think that the Nazis, in experimenting with the Bell, exposed probably, you know, in addition to animals, they probably exposed some concentration camp victims to its field effects as well. So I think monstrous in terms of its applications, but certainly monstrous in terms of its potential, absolutely.
What also in the book you discuss about the creation of artificial rubies. How does that fit into this?
Well, that's an interesting comment because it actually comes from the declassified farm hall transcripts, which of course were again those British secret recordings that they made of the German atomic bomb scientists. And one of them, a fellow by the name of Horst Korsching, just kind of makes this little passing reference to making artificial rubies. And, you know, that just kind of stops you cold because, of course, artificial rubies were the optical cavity in the first laser that mankind built in the early 1960s. So, you know, again, what does this indicate about what the Germans are actually doing during the war? And there's always been persistent rumors that they were dealing with directed energy weapons of some sort. And a British author by the name of Tom Augustin in 1985 came out and just said flatly that they were working on lasers. So again, where they actually were and where we have been told they were in terms of their scientific achievement are really two very different things.
You think there's a possibility that the Germans actually created an atomic bomb?
Oh, yes, I do. Absolutely, I do.
And what's the evidence for that?
Well, it's again, a largely circumstantial case, but it kind of kicked loose when the Clinton administration declassified in 1992, very early into their administration, or pardon me, 93, an affidavit of a German test pilot who was flying a bomber, twin-engine bomber, out over the Baltic Sea toward the island of Rügen, which is over close toward where the Germans were building their V-2 rockets. And he described, in his words, what he described as an atomic bomb test. He saw a blast radius wave that was approximately a kilometer to a kilometer and a half in diameter, which would be the approximate size for a nuclear device. But more importantly, he describes the electrical malfunction of his equipment in his aircraft, and he describes a mushroom cloud, those are again his words, and continuing combustion of the nuclear material in the cloud, in terms of description of colors and hues and so on that he saw in the fireball. So in other words, this is a very important document, George, because we have in it a description, an accurate description of a test of a nuclear bomb, which no one has seen and knows how to describe prior to this point in history. So it's a very, very crucial document. And when we put that together with some of the other things I talk about in Reich of the Black Sun, the Auschwitz so-called synthetic rubber plant. And another interesting piece of information that I discovered was that during 1944, at approximately the same time as this German pilot saw this test, Great Britain put all of its constables, fire departments, and medical teams around the entire country on secret emergency alert precisely against the possibility of a German atomic bomb attack. So in other words, the circumstantial evidence after German reunification is beginning to point very clearly to a much more successful Nazi atomic bomb project than we have been led to believe.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, here's the central question, perhaps the central question of the night. If we inherited or stole or acquired this technology, and if we've been able to master it, if we've been able to improve upon it, to make use of it, describe for me how it could be used now, what it could be used for, what kinds of things it could accomplish.
Well, if we extrapolate out from what I believe may have been some of the underlying physics of the bell, then, you know, we've had 60 years, or whoever has this technology has, and I'm convinced that somebody does, we've had 60 years since the end of the war to develop it. So there's no question in my mind that somebody on this planet has the ability to construct so-called over-unity devices, which really are not over-unity in the popular term, but simply radically much more efficient energy devices than we have in use now. But there's no doubt in my mind that somebody has that, and as a consequence of it, there is no doubt in my mind that somebody somewhere would have some sort of field propulsion capability. Now, as to whether or not anybody has been able to weaponize this, I don't know. My guess is probably so. And if that is the case, you know, then God help us all, because that, again, is a physics with a weaponization potential that is just absolutely enormous. It's far, far beyond our largest thermonuclear weapons.
Well, I guess we can safely conclude then that if they have it, they haven't used it. Nobody's right. Uncorked a big bomb like that. Is there any evidence that that they use it for lesser things like time travel or whatever?
Well, again, I don't think that the device and the science would exist for practical time travel quite yet. But again, that is some of the nature of the byproduct of the physics that we're talking about. So certainly somebody, you know, humanity being what humanity is, somebody probably is tinkering around with it for that purpose. So again, you know, this stuff goes in any number of ways.
Well, one of the ways it could go is you speculate about the existence of a secret space program.
Oh,
and maybe
yeah.
We're using this thing to go to the stars and just not telling anyone about it. And we're going to talk to you about that when we come back right after this short break. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, your guest host. My guest is Joseph Farrell. We've been speaking about the SS Brotherhood of the Bell and learning a lot about history that isn't in the history books. You're blowing my mind here, Joseph.
Well,
I guess that's the point. Let's talk about the possibility that there are two space programs. You know, you hear these statements every once in a while from folks in connection with advanced technology that we have. Hints, for example, about what might have happened out at Area 51. You know, I heard that quote back in the late 80s, that there are things out there that would make George Lucas drool, and that we're 50 years ahead of anything you could imagine, and hints from people like the late Ben Rich that maybe we've already been to the stars and back.
Right.
Do you believe it's possible that we are using this technology in some other kind of space program that the public has not been told about?
Yes, I do, and let me get into some of the details why. Let's go back to that other scientist that I mentioned that was connected with the Bell, Dr. Kurt Davis, the one that I mentioned I have a picture of in the book with Dr. von Braun. He was, again, the one of the administrators at the Kennedy Space Flight Center during the Apollo mission. And this man is not even a rocket scientist. He's an electrical engineer. And again, he was the man that designed the power plant for the Bell. Now, I want to make something very clear before I proceed, and that is I am not, absolutely, definitely not one of those people that believes that the Apollo moon missions were hoaxed. I do not believe that at all. But I think that some of the anomalies that those people are pointing out are really signatures or indicators of an alternative technology that may have been deployed, not necessarily so much in getting us to the moon, but in getting us off the moon. And the reason I say that is, again, one of those things that the hoaxers point out that is an unusual signature for a rocket is that the lunar excursion module, the LEM, the television pictures that you see of that module taking off from the moon don't really look too much like the signatures of a rocket. The thing just sort of pops up and more or less flies away at a uniform, what appears to be a uniform rate of speed, which, again, a rocket accelerates geometrically per unit of time. So that, to me, is a little indicator that there may have been an alternative technology involved in getting us off the moon that everybody wishes to keep quiet. And in that respect, I should point out another significant detail. Dr. von Braun himself gave an interview for Time magazine shortly after the first lunar landing, in which he quoted a neutral point for the gravitational attraction between the Earth and the Moon at approximately 43,500 miles from the surface of the Moon, which is not where it would need to be if the Moon were merely one-sixth the gravity of the Earth. If that were the case, that neutral point would have been much closer, something like 23 to 25,000 miles, if I recall my figures correctly, from the surface of the Moon. So in other words, the figure indicates that the Moon is possibly a much more massive object than we have been told publicly. And for that reason, then, it would have required a rather different technology than the mere rockets on the lunar excursion module to get us off the moon. So again, I think that there may have been an alternative technology in play during the Apollo missions.
And do you, to take it a step further then, do you believe then that it's possible we're using it now to zip around the solar system or the galaxy or something like that could be going on and we haven't heard about it?
Well, to crawl way out on a limb here, yes. I mean, if we go back to the speculation that this technology has been in existence since World War II, and then whoever has it has had 60 years to develop it, then yes, it's possible.
You mentioned Wernher von Braun a couple of times.
Right.
Any indication that he was involved in this research back in Germany?
Ah, that's an excellent question. Let's go back to the internal evidences of the Magic 12 documents. One of the things that kind of caught my eye when I read them was that in General Twining's so-called white-hot intelligence estimate, it mentions that they bring in the paperclip scientists to look at the Roswell wreckage. Now, I thought that a very peculiar thing for our military to be doing if it had suspected that that technology was extraterrestrial. Why would we be sharing one of our deepest national security secrets with a bunch of ex-Nazis who are tinkering with our rockets? I just don't think that security compartmentalization would have allowed that. However, one of the things that then goes on in the documents to describe is the technology that these German scientists, after looking at the wreckage, come up with. And it has all the appearance of being little indicators of connections to projects that the SS was involved with during the war. So on the basis of the internal evidence, then, yes, von Braun may have had some sort of inside knowledge as to other projects going on in Nazi Germany back when he was their chief rocket scientist. And again, we have to remember that this Dr. Kurt Davis was a member of his rocket building teams as well as one of the chief scientists involved in the Bell project.
Well, let's stick with Roswell for a second.
Sure.
The Roswell community, the community of Roswell researchers, isn't going to like the idea that this might have been some sort of Earth technology that crashed there. What do you think crashed at Roswell?
Well, to be quite honest with you, again, going back to my argument from internal evidence, since the biological aspect of the story, and as far as the documents are concerned, is the part of the story that most cinches the case for ET in other people's minds about Roswell, and since that evidence in the documents is blacked out, on the basis of the extant internal evidence, then I have to conclude that it was a terrestrial craft. Now, what does this mean in terms of our military's response to it? if they're bringing in paperclip scientists, if that really happened, and for the sake of argument, let's suppose that it did, if they really did that, then the military is going to panic not so much because this is an ET craft that has crashed, but it's because it is something Nazi, and that means that somebody out there is continuing an independent line of development of this technology that is not under Allied or Soviet control.
Have you had much interaction with the UFO community about this theory? I mean, I just wondered if they'd jump all over you about it.
No, I have not. I've had people contact me quietly and say that I may be onto something here. I've interviewed with Whitley Strieber, for example, and he thinks that there might be an angle to this story that might indeed be terrestrial on that basis. But otherwise, no, I haven't had much reaction from the UFO community at all. It's more like deadly silence.
Well, like I offered before, we'll try to stir it up for you, see if we can rain some grief on your head here. In keeping with the Roswell area, you're familiar, of course, with Colonel Phil Corso.
Oh, yeah.
And his book, The Day After Roswell. You know, I got to interview him 5 or 6 years before that book came out and found it to be interesting. Give me your take on Colonel Corso, then. If you don't believe that the Roswell craft was E.T., then his story, a lot of it would have to go out the window, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, it does. But I should point out that Colonel Corso himself, and I quote these little sections in my book, Colonel Corso himself indicated that there is some sort of connection to the Nazi paperclip scientists, but he doesn't really go into very much detail. But as far as the actual in allegations and claims that he makes in his book, one of the most interesting to my mind was his claim that the transistor was developed using seeded extraterrestrial technology that was borrowed from the Roswell crash. And he points out quite rightly that the history of the transistor is somewhat obscure prior to its announcement. But I point out in the SS Brotherhood of Abel, I even have a picture of this thing, of a little German Klystron tube, which is a little vacuum tube, that is about as big as the last knuckle on your pinky finger. So it's a very small tube. And it was in existence and used by the Germans as early as 1940. Now, the Allied equivalent of this little tube at the end of the war is 10 times as large. So the Germans were making great strides in the miniaturization of electronic components for their secret projects. And the other thing that's very interesting is that the Germans were also making great strides in semiconductor technology, which is another necessary component on the technology tree to the transistor. So I subject a lot of these claims and allegations that Colonel Corso makes to this historical analysis, and in almost every case I can find you some glimmer or some clue that there might be a Nazi antecedent to it.
So, like, there is a cover story for a cover story for a cover story. Corso
exactly.
Corso is telling people this is hinting that it was recovered from Soviet crashes, when in reality he believed it was from E.T., but somehow this may have been a cover for it was really from Nazi technology.
Right.
Well, is there anything, the other parts of what he said was about fiber optics coming
right.
from this and about, I think, night vision goggles, anything
right.
like that? You find any paper trail for that kind of research in Germany?
Well, in respect to infrared sight and night vision, the Germans were pioneers of that technology and actually had it deployed as early as the Battle of the Bulge in 1944. They equipped, I believe it was a battalion of Panther tanks with some infrared sights, and they fought with great effectiveness during the Battle of the Bulge.
Okay, well, we're talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell about the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and when we come back, we're going to find out if there's a connection between all of this and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We're getting our brains rattled by Joseph Farrell, who's written a book, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, about secret Nazi technology that may have been acquired by our government and now in the hands of multinational corporations, and how it might have been confused. What we're thinking of as UFOs from outer space or some other dimension might be good old technology born here on Earth. And, you know, I'm looking at it, at the book, and I didn't remember seeing this the first time, but we're making comparisons between some of the technology that may have been developed there in Nazi Germany and what we consider to be UFOs. And there's a photo of Kenneth Arnold from his he's looking at a sketch of the vehicles that he saw, the first big UFO case of the modern UFO era. And then the comparison is made in the book to the Horton brothers' flying wing, something that was developed and flown in Germany as early as 1939. And boy, from a certain angle, they look almost exactly alike. That's one of the fascinating discoveries that that Dr. Farrell reports in his book. The other, perhaps most controversial part of it, is whether or not any of this stuff had to do, had played a role in the assassination of President John Kennedy. And we're going to be talking to Dr. Farrell about that as soon as we take this break. I'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Speaking with Joseph Farrell about the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. I mentioned before the break, Joseph, the uncanny resemblance between what Kenneth Arnold saw and sketched back in 1947 and the Horton brothers' flying wing. What's the significance of that comparison?
Well, the comparison is, as you pointed out, that they look almost completely identical. And the Horton brothers, as you mentioned, flew that flying wing in Nazi Germany as early as 1939. So, and again, much of their work and research was brought to this country. We know this for a fact after the war, and it was stationed at Wright-Patterson Air Base, of all places. So again, the little dots connect in so many different ways, and it wouldn't surprise me that a company like Northrop, which was building its own flying wing, may have continued to develop their concepts on the basis of some of Horton's research. So it's my speculation, really, that probably what Kenneth Arnold saw that initiated the first UFO flap in this country after the war was something that may have been a development or even just plain old Nazi technology.
You think there's a connection between the atomic bombs that we uncorked at the end of the war and waves of UFO sightings in subsequent years?
Oh, yes, I do. I think that Stanton Friedman is exactly right, that they show up not without coincidence at our most sensitive military installations. But the thing that I point out is that they start showing up in our country in 1947, 2 years after our first atomic bomb test in New Mexico in July of 1945. But they also show up over the Baltic and in Scandinavia in 1946, which would place it 2 years after the German A-bomb test that took place in 1944. So in other words, we have a case where these UFO flaps are beginning to occur precisely 2 years after some of these tests. So, that's kind of a coincidence.
Well, let's pursue that further. Does it take them 2 years to get here from wherever they're coming from?
It may. That's anybody's guess. It may. It may very well.
All right, let's talk about JFK.
Sure.
This is a pretty controversial part of your book. We've heard in the UFO field, we've heard this for years, that maybe there was a connection, that JFK wanted to spill the secrets about Roswell or UFOs,
right,
or that maybe he told his brother Bobby and Bobby told Marilyn Monroe, and that's why Marilyn Monroe had to be killed as well. What is the connection to all of this, and what is the evidence that it might have a role in the assassination?
Well, let's go back a bit. There is a Nazi connection to the JFK assassination, and it's one of those connections that very few researchers really want to touch. In fact, the only one that I know of who did so rather extensively was the old talk show host, Mae Bressel. But let's go back to history and talk about another aspect of what would become Operation Paperclip. In 1944, Alan Dulles was the station chief for the OSS, which was the wartime version of the CIA, in Zurich, Switzerland. And he was approached by a German general by the name of Reinhard Gehlen, who was in charge of Germany's Fremde Heere Ost, which was its military intelligence analysis unit for all of the Eastern Front. General Gehlen ran a network of thousands of agents inside of the Soviet Union and inside of Eastern Europe as the war progressed. And he offered Dulles a deal. And the deal was that since he knew the Americans would need on-the-ground human intelligence inside of the Eastern Bloc after the war, he offered to turn over his entire military intelligence network to the American government in return for that network being kept in place, not prosecuted for any war crimes, and with him as the day-to-day head of operations. Now, pause and consider what that really means. It means that when President Truman signed the National Security Act of 1947 into law, the civilian character and charter of the CIA had already been compromised because, for all intents and purposes, the operational desk of the Soviet desk of the CIA was in the hands of a bunch of Nazis. And as subsequent history turned out and pointed out, many of these agents turned double agents for the Soviet Union, and that means the possibility exists quite clearly that they remained agents ultimately for some sort of independent Nazi combine and were working for their own best interest. So, you know, we have that little aspect of the story. Now, when President Kennedy comes along and signs that National Security Memorandum, I think it was 272 or 273, I forget the exact number right offhand, that, in his own words, he threatened to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces. He is taking direct aim at this coterie of Nazis that are using the CIA as a front to legitimize their continuing operations after the war. So in other words, on that point alone, the Nazis have a clear motivation to be involved in the Kennedy assassination. Now there's another odd, interesting little detail that came out in the Warren Commission that very few researchers ever point out, and that is that one of Lee Harvey Oswald's Marine buddies not only heard him speaking Russian, but also speaking a language that he thought was German. And when Oswald was arrested, not only did he have the names of FBI agent James Hoste and his address and phone number contacts, not only did he have that name, not only did he have General Edward Walker's name and address and phone number, but he also had the name, address, and phone number of one George Lincoln Rockwell. And some of your listeners out there may be old enough to remember that man. I certainly am. I remember seeing him on TV.
Yeah.
That man was the president of the American Nazi Party. So the question is, what are these connections doing in Oswald's address book, and why? Why are they there? So you add all this together, there is, at least from the intelligence angle, a pervasive Nazi influence and therefore a motivation to be involved in the assassination, and they certainly would have had the means and ability to pull something like that off. They were masters at counterintelligence operations of that sort. On the technology side,
Do you think that JFK would have known about the bell?
I think that he would most likely not have known about that, but that he certainly would have suspected, given his knowledge of the CIA and so on and so forth. He certainly would have been alarmed, as was President Eisenhower before him, of this pervasive foreign influence in the analysis and gathering of intelligence in the Eastern Bloc. And that highlights another little thing I want to bring up. I believe that when President Eisenhower gave his speech warning about the military-industrial complex, that he wasn't warning just about ours. He was warning about the Nazis as well, because he had just fought that military-industrial complex in the war. He knew its outlines, its shape, its mechanisms, its motives, and so on and so forth. So there's all of these connections to the Kennedy assassination that really don't get much attention in the assassination research community that I think need to be brought out.
And have you taken it further to analyze how this fits in with other kinds of the physical evidence about how the assassination was carried out and the other theories that the mob or CIA or others were involved?
Well, I do mention it. I do mention all of those aspects. But the one thing that kind of sticks out to my mind as the group that would be most affected by Kennedy smashing the CIA as he planned to do, would have been this rogue network of Nazis ostensibly working for the American government, and then by that time, of course, for the West German government as well. So I think he had to have at least suspected that there was perhaps a technological aspect of this story too. And if the Nazis were involved in it, and particularly if they had any sort of independent programs going on that were being coordinated by this intelligence group of General Galen's, then yes, they would have had a clear motive to be involved in the assassination.
Tell me this. I know, you know, history has taught us that that there were isolated instances of Nazis, high-ranking Nazis, escaping and living for decades in South America, etc. Do you think that there is evidence that, that any kind of substantial number of Nazis were able to get out and carry on and carry out their existence, their programs, whatever, outside of Paperclip, outside of our government?
Oh, yes, I do. In fact, General Juan Perón, who was at the time president of Argentina, built four these Nazi scientists prior to the end of the war and had ready and waiting for them after the war a modern, for its day, a very modern plasma physics research laboratory in San Juan de Bariloche province of Argentina, which is very remote over toward the border of Chile. And if you look at the photos of, and I have some photos in my collection of the German settlements there, they look like little Bavarian chalets. It's just like a little bit of transplanted Germany. And these scientists went to Argentina and actually continued their plasma physics research, even some rumors involved them in researching fusion physics. So in other words, yes, there was a clear financial and personnel and security apparatus that the Nazis put in place inside of South America after the war that allowed them to have a sufficient infrastructure to continue some of these projects. Absolutely.
You know, you hear these stories over the years about the Nazis, a lot of them escaped. They built a secret base in Antarctica. Others say that they might have a, you know, some kind of base in the hollow earth, things of that sort. Any indication that about the Antarctica part of it, at least?
Well, yeah, again, you know, this is another aspect of the story that is so very bizarre. The Germans sent an expedition to Antarctica in 1938 and early 1939, ostensibly for the purpose of claiming portions of it. But they outfitted a seaplane tender on this expedition with a shipboard scientific laboratory. They recruited a bunch of scientists. They went down there. They collected shot penguins and walruses and froze them to take them back to Germany to learn how to make nutritional food out of them. And then they flew planes over a huge area of Antarctica, claimed it for themselves, and did basically nothing but photographic mapping. And there have always been persisting rumors that they found warm water springs, caves in the ice, and so on and so forth, which they turned into bases. Now, there's really no substantiating evidence for any of this except two very odd facts. The first fact is that the sponsor of that Nazi expedition to Antarctica before the war was none other than Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring, the head of the German Luftwaffe. Now, this is not a man that's going to be sponsoring a science project. He has a completely military purpose in mind, but no one really knows what it is because all records of that expedition were so deeply classified by the Third Reich after it happened that no one really knows anything about it. The other odd circumstance that points to something going on in Antarctica by the Nazis is the fact that at the end of the war, several U-boats, cargo-carrying U-boats, turn up about 3 to 4 months after the German surrender in Argentina. And when the Argentine authorities question these U-boat captains as to where they've been and what have they been doing for the last 4 months, you know, the answer is basically, oh, we were just sort of sailing around. Well, you know, most likely they were doing something in Antarctica, but nobody really knows what.
One of our listeners had sent me an email last night. His name is Roger in Atlanta. He sent this to ask about Nazi expeditions into the Himalayas. Is there any...
Oh, yeah.
Are you familiar? Is there a connection?
Oh, yes. There is definitely a connection. The SS, prior to the war, had a branch or a department that was set up by Reichsfuhrer Himmler himself called the Ahnenerbe-Dienst, and its sole purpose was to investigate avenues of the occult and of the esoteric for the purposes of military exploitation. Now, Himmler sponsored an expedition to Tibet, to the Himalayas, in 1938 and early 1939. There's just been a book come out about that expedition, as a matter of fact. I forget what the title is right offhand, but this expedition did go to Tibet, and it did make its way all the way to Lhasa and even into the Potala itself. And the expedition returned to Germany with a complete set of the Tibetan Kangshur, which is a very, very ancient set of Tibetan Buddhist manuscripts, hundreds if not thousands of years old. Most of it has never been translated into any Western language, and nobody really knows what happened to that edition of the Kangshur after the war. It simply falls off the face of the map. So yes, there is definitely a connection with all of this stuff.
I'd also been told by a listener about something called Hanabu Project, which I guess was these flying discs and some research into that. And there was speculation that Rear Admiral Richard Byrd, who went to Antarctica to look around, might have encountered something like that. I know it's wild speculation, but any connection to that, Hanabu or Byrd?
Well, there's actually two questions there. I've never been satisfied that any of those photographs or drawings of the so-called Hanabu flying discs are, in fact, legitimate. I think that they might be very clever disinformation. That being said, Admiral Byrd outfitted an entire expedition to go to Antarctica after the war, interestingly enough, in the year 1947. It was outfitted for a stay of 8 months. It took a battalion of Marines, a light aircraft escort carrier, several destroyers and destroyer escorts, and a submarine seaplane tender. And in other words, this is a large military operation. It's outfitted for 8 weeks instead, after a mere 8 weeks, Admiral Byrd calls it quits and hightails it back to the United States. But along the way, he gives an interview for the El Mercurio newspaper in Santiago de Chile, in which he says, and I reproduce the actual article in Reich of the Black Sun, the Spanish version, so you can actually see this article. In the interview, he tells the reporter that the United States has to prepare itself for enemy fighters that can fly from pole to pole with tremendous speed. So there's always been speculation that he encountered some of these Nazis and their advanced projects down in Antarctica.
Wow.
Yeah.
any indication of who would know about this stuff now? Would I asked you about JFK, but would Bush know? Guessing, I guess.
That's a real big box to open up right before the top of the hour.
It's the same question that people have asked about UFOs. Sure. Would the president be informed?
Well, I think to a certain extent, with the Bush family, we're dealing with a very special case because their connections with the Germans go back prior to World War II, and they're rather murky connections at that. My suspicion is that President Bush would probably be one of the better informed presidents on the subject, and even more particularly his father.
Any kind of indication that there's any? I mean, Area 51. We've mentioned this, and you'd figure if something like that really fell into our hands, that Area 51 would be one of the places where we might test it. Sure. Have you ever seen Groom Lake pop up in any of this discussion?
No, I never have. Not to my knowledge. That's not to say that it wouldn't be out there. It's just I haven't run into it, and I do try and do my research rather thoroughly, so I'd lay about a 90% chance that there's not been any mention of it.
Have you had any kind of any people come? Well, I think we're going to go to a break now, and I'll ask this question when we come back, and then we'll be opening it up to phone lines. I'm sure our listeners have many questions for our guest, Dr. Joseph Farrell. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Stick around, everybody. Talking about all kinds of weird technology with Joseph Farrell, who's been knocking our socks off here for the last couple of hours. And I'm going to have one more question, and then we're going to open it up to our listeners to call in. Joseph, I guess, you were talking about the possibility that pockets of Nazis were able to get out of Germany, maybe set up bases and communities elsewhere, and carry on, and maybe they took some of this technology with them. That's a scary proposition. If they were able to bring this technology, that it's not only in our hands, but it's in theirs, and I would presume if they have it, then maybe the Russians could have it. any indication that, someone else has it other than us?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think you have to look, and I get into this in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell quite a bit. I think you have to look to nations like Russia, France, Great Britain, Germany, certainly, Japan, being the principal ones that would have had some handle on this technology after the war, particularly the Russians. So, yes, the question is an excellent one, and I think the answer has to be yes.
Okay, we're going to open it up now. We're going to our wild card line, Carolyn in Michigan. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I'm just fascinated by what I'm hearing. I can't believe I got through. I read a book years ago by journalist Jeff Baker called Checkmate, Game of the Princes. Checkmate as in chess, C-H-E-Q-U-E. Anyway, it's about how the government's getting ready to slam dunk us into the New World Order. It's about the world mafia. It's about how in the late 50s, early 60s, they began building these detention centers, which they have everywhere now. They hold between 40 and 50,000 people each. They're on government land. You don't dare go on it. They're called blue zones. One-way turnstile gates, barbed wire fencing, faces in, not out. In other words, to keep people in. And the book goes on to explain how he went to congressmen and senators, so what is this, what's going on. And long story short, my question is, I'm wondering if this is a piece of this everything that your guest is talking about. Has he ever read the book? Does he know about these government land detention centers that hold between 40 and 50,000 people each, the largest in two states? Can hold 80,000 people, unfinished railroad tracks in the back. And he goes on to talk about many other things in this book, Checkmate, The Game of Princes, which is about the world mafia.
Joseph, have you heard of him? Yeah, have you heard of that book, Joseph?
Yeah, Carolyn, actually I have the book, and I have read it. In answer to your question, I think that, yes, we do have to look at the Nazi party, the Nazi ideology, as being self-consciously and by its own explicit description, a party that was enamored of what we would now call New World Order. That was actually a phrase often found on Hitler's lips during his speeches. So, yes, I think that there is a connection, although I would hesitate to speculate any further. I simply don't have enough basis in research to go much further than that. But I think that there is a connection, certainly.
Carolyn, did you have another question along these lines?
Exact. Hello?
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 Yes, Carolyn, did you have another question?
Oh, yes, Waco. Waco was an exact duplicate of what Hitler did to a little Jewish community, saying they were hoarding guns and molesting children. And the government, which is not supposed to attack its own people, went in and did the same exact thing to this little Jewish village that happened at Waco. And then they went in and covered everything up and bulldozed it exactly the same, and then came out with a propaganda movie, as they did with David Koresh, to kind of get the populace to go along with more accepting of what happened. And I thought, wow, that 50 years to the day, and in the same way the Nazis did it. So it's just, boy, we're living in times that are just absolutely, we've got to have the knowledge of what is really going on.
There's spooky stuff going on out there. Anything else to add to that, Joseph?
Well, the only thing I would add is that I think if we look at some of the things going on in this country, it is hardly accidental if we took over a group of Nazis into this country in our scientific projects and basically created a rogue element inside of our intelligence community so shortly after the end of the war. I don't think it's an accident at all. If we take over the science that they developed and the technology that they developed, to a certain extent, we're making the Faustian bargain and we're taking over the ideology as well.
We're going to go to our West of the Rockies line, Rod in Hermosa Beach. What's on your mind, Rod?
Good evening, George. I want to say very quickly here, first of all, I want to thank you so much for putting your own professional reputation and your own your own life, basically, here on the line for doing the work that you've done with Robert Scott Lazar. I thank you so much for bringing that material here to the American public, because you're a serious journalist, and I thank you so much for doing that. Very quickly here, I'm an aeronautical engineer, and I was involved in some research here regarding the ME-262, as well as a plane called the ME-264. And I had an opportunity to go very extensively here into the National Archives and do a lot of research in the course of what I was doing. Now, I want to ask Mr. Farrell here if he's ever had this happen to him. When I wanted to look at certain records of the Ananarba, I was told, despite the fact here that I had a relatively high security clearance, I was able to do my work regarding the aeronautical aspects of these aircraft. This was classified at a level beyond rhyolite, if you know what that term means. In other words, this is one of the most absolutely highest classifications here in the National Archives right now, and that I was completely barred from looking at any of these records. Have you ever looked into the records of the Ananarba in the National Archives? That's my question.
No, I have not looked other than in a very cursory fashion. However, I will say this in kind of a loose-ended confirmation of your experience. Most of my attempts to deal with these records have met just basically a stone wall. And I have a few good contacts that I use to get me other information out of the archives. And again, the story is the same. So there's something going on with the Ananarba to this day that we, for some reason, still consider a high national security item. And I have no idea what it would be other than to speculate and guess that it has some connection to this type of physics that the Nazis were investigating. Beyond that, I can't say anything more other than to confirm your basic experience.
Well, I'd be very surprised if our government did release documents on this stuff, and that,
right.
Not surprised at all that they're classified. Thanks for the question, Rod. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with more of your questions for our guest. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. As I was saying, welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, your guest host, and my guest tonight is Joseph Farrell, author of The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And now we're going to go back to the phone lines with Frank on the first-time caller line. Frank in Houston, Texas, what's going on?
Good morning, George. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning, Frank.
I wish I would have postponed my trip about a week. I actually just got back from Las Vegas.
Oh, boy.
Well, my question to you, Joseph, is there anything to suggest that some of the Jews imprisoned at Auschwitz might have been unknowingly, or knowingly for that matter, involved with the construction of the Bell or the day-to-day operations of the quote-unquote synthetic rubber plant?
Oh, yes, definitely they would have been involved. That plant was so huge that it required the assistance of some 25,000 slave laborers in addition to 10,000 German technicians that had been moved into the area just to operate it. So, in other words, we're not dealing with a synthetic rubber plant, and there's no doubt in my mind that many Jews would have been induced into slave labor, and unfortunately, given the nature of the Nazi ideology, when they were used up, they were expendable. That's an excellent question.
Was that it?
That
Frank?
Was it. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Guys, taking the call.
Thanks. We're going to go to our wild card line, Lewis, from right here in Las Vegas. What's going on?
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Mr. Farrell. Pleasure to speak to you, George. I'm a big fan, long-time reader of yours.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask a question of Mr. Farrell. Considering the circumstances that are going on today, from what I've a little bit of the reading and exposure, some of the stuff I've seen on television through documentaries and stuff like that, there's a connection also, a Nazi connection with the Arab world.
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if, you know, obviously when that broke up, pretty much the same concern with the Soviets, Soviet scientists who had knowledge and ability of nuclear physicists and stuff like that, they find themselves out of a job real quick, and they're going to go where they got to go.
Right.
I'm wondering if a branch of the Nazis also went into that world, because that world resembles an organization and in style closer to the style and organization of the Nazis, in that they have complete control and absolute control over society and the people. And I'm wondering if what we're fighting now And part of the reason why it doesn't seem to be illogical or it doesn't seem to make sense what this president's doing and what's going on is because there's something that we're fighting that can't be told and can't be explained to us. And if this may be part of the scenario.
Oh, an excellent, excellent, excellent question. The short answer, Lewis, is that there is a connection between the Nazis and radical Islam. And the connection is this. There was a fellow in Egypt that started the Muslim Brotherhood by the name of Bana. And he was directly contacted and in contact with the Nazis during the period that he was forming the Muslim Brotherhood. There's also a connection prior to the war with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was inducted honorarily into the ranks of the SS. And many of the documents, if you look in the Arab world today, they publish things like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and so on and so forth. Well, many of those documents, in my opinion, made their way into Arab hands, into radical Muslim hands, via the Nazis and their contacts in the region during the war, and certainly after the war. Another connection I have to mention, since you raised the possibility of scientific involvement, the civilian head of General Kammler, the SS general I mentioned in the first hour, the civilian head of his secret weapons think tank was a fellow by the name of Dr. Wilhelm Voss. And he actually went to Egypt at the behest of the West German government and at the behest of President Gamal Abdel Nasser to train the Egyptian army in the use of advanced weapons and to give them some of those weapons. So in other words, there is a connection even there. So I would not be at all surprised if something that we're fighting is more than just radical Islam and their terrorist organizations. There may be other entities at work.
Wow, these Nazis had their fingers in everything. Thanks for the call, Lewis.
Yep, in every pie.
Thanks for the call, Lewis. We're going to go to east of the Rockies, George in Ohio. You're up mighty early this morning. Or
yes,
late.
Good to hear you. Now, hello?
Hello. What's on your mind?
Yeah, the GM connection back with the Nazi Empire. Now, the power glide transmissions were designed up, and that all came from Germany at the end of the war.
I'm sorry here, Colin. I'm having a bit of trouble understanding what you're referring to. Could you spell it out a little bit more?
I think he's saying that General Motors has some sort of a Nazi connection, that we've got an automatic transmission technology from them.
Oh, yes. Okay, yes. There is a corporate connection, and in fact, several corporate connections between the United States and Nazi Germany during the war, and General Motors is one of them. Yes, he's correct in that.
George, did you want to take it further?
The designer of it was one that came through with the project paperclip or whatever about that same time, along with Braun and two or three others. That's how he came back over from Germany.
I didn't know that. That's very
thanks. Thanks for the call, George. Thanks for staying up with us. We're going to go west of the Rockies, Slim in Salem, Oregon. How's it going, Slim?
Yeah, it's going good. Gentlemen, how's it with you?
We're doing good.
that's good. Say, I'm sure glad you jumped on this topic because, boy, not very many of the talk shows want to even get close to associate the Bush dynasty with the Nazis. But like you were saying, their connection goes all the way back to before the First World War when the grandfather, Preston, Sheldon Washington was operating the Union Banking Corporation, and that was a bank for the Thyssen steel manufacturing, and it helped Hitler build his empire.
Right. Well, Fritz Thyssen and the Union Banking Company have deep connections with each other. You're absolutely correct.
Chance, have you read the book? It's called Fleshing Out the Skull and Bones.
Yes, I have.
Well, boy, that book is just chock full of information, and I think it really gets down and puts the pinpoint right on who did assassinate JFK, And you can trace it right back to the CIA assassination squad 40, which has a picture in there. And if you look at those the picture of the three tramps, my goodness, there they are. There's three members of the CIA assassination squad right there.
Well, I don't know about that aspect of it, but let's just look back historically to that deal that was struck between Alan Dulles and General Galen with German military intelligence. Certainly, German military intelligence was running those types of squads and commando outfits behind the Soviet lines during the war. And certainly they would have been capable of maintaining those types of operations. And certainly, given the nature of the deal that Dulles and Galen worked out, it would be a case of plausible deniability. You know, operations of that sort would be something that, well, the Germans would be blamed for, not necessarily the Americans. So historically, there's a context for what you're saying.
Yes, it is. It even goes as far as that. It has references where they have wiretapped messages between J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI chief, and it also pinpoints George Herbert Walker Bush as being part of that, you might say part of the assassination team.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but there is a curious reference that assassination researchers have uncovered to a G.W. Bush and Operation Zapata in connection with the Bay of Pigs incident. And given that this is all something partially based out of Texas, then certainly George Herbert Walker Sr. would be the one that they're referring to. So that connection's always been suspected by assassination researchers.
Slim, thanks for the call. We'll go back to the phones in a moment. Sticking with the JFK subject, sure. What is the Torbit document? And you say that JFK researchers sort of avoid that.
Well, it is one of those curious documents that was circulated in the 1970s, kind of underground. It was drawn up by a Texas lawyer. And the basic thrust of the document is that there is some sort of Nazi connection and a connection to the space program hovering in the background of the Kennedy assassination. Now, the interesting thing about the document itself is that it purports to be a kind of a summary of the weirder aspects of the Garrison investigation during the 1960s. So, you know, you can just imagine Attorney General Garrison or District Attorney Garrison running into all of this Nazi stuff and wondering, what in the name of sense do I do with this? You know, it didn't even make it into Oliver Stone's movie. So,
And was this, I mean, this is a real document? Was it in the files of the Warren Commission or something?
No, it was never in the files of the Warren Commission. It was circulated in the 70s, years after the Warren Commission had actually completed its report. It circulated for years underground, and it was republished by my publisher, I think back in the late 1980s, early 1990s.
Is there some kind of reference to Fred Chrisman in that stuff?
Oh, yes, there certainly is. There certainly is. And that, of course, opens up another can of worms because, of course, he is involved with the Maury Island UFO affair and all of those peculiar goings-on. And once we start talking about that, then there's a connection to Guy Bannister because he's the FBI field agent in the Billings or Butte, Montana field office up there who's responsible for collating all UFO reports and sending them along to Washington, D.C.
Joseph, you got to stop. My head's going to explode here. We're going to take another short break. We'll be right back with more of your questions for my guest, Joseph Farrell, here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We're in the home stretch with Dr. Joseph Farrell, the author of The SS Brotherhood of the Bell and Mixing Up Nazis, JFK, UFOs, Time Travel. It's, we're through the looking glass here. A lot of folks are calling with questions for us. I'm just going to ask you, when we come to you, get right to it, because we want to cover as many of these questions as we can. In fact, let's go to Brad in Dallas, who's been holding a long time on Wildcard 3 line. Brad, are you there?
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
What's your question?
Joseph, now Hitler, the first people that he rounded up and put into concentration camps, I'm trying to think the name of the town. This may be the wrong pronunciation. I believe it was Anschwitz. I'm not real sure of the correct pronunciation of the town. But anyway, this was the base of the free economy movement, which was basically a interest-free money. Mm-hmm. And this was spreading all over Europe and the world. It started by a man by the name of Silvio Gazzelle. I was wondering if there's any tie to Hitler and international bankers to try to control this movement before it got out of hand. Have you heard of him or this movement?
No, I haven't. However, one of the interesting financial policies that Hitler put in place in the Third Reich via a fellow by the name of Hjalmar Schacht, who became president of the Reichsbank, was essentially the German equivalent of constitutional money. So he effectively overnight transformed the economy of Germany and made it prosperous by doing that. So it would not surprise me that in the process of doing something like that, that he would have clamped down on any little independent groups trying to do a similar thing.
This was a worldwide movement. You can barely find mention of it in any encyclopedia, but Irving Fisher wrote extensively about this project in a book called Sanskrit.
Right.
So you might want to check that out, and maybe you can link some ties up with that.
Hey, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. We're going to go to our East of the Rockies line. Steve is up, my dear, early this morning in St. Louis. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I wanted to touch again on the Bush family a bit. I've heard recently that Prescott Bush, who I believe is George W.'s grandfather.
That's correct.
Was a Nazi sympathizer, from what I've heard. And is there any connection through the Bush family along that line?
Well, I don't know if he was so much of a Nazi sympathizer. However, he certainly had very, very deep business dealings with a German industrialist by the name of Fritz Thyssen, who was the head of a very large steel conglomerate inside of Nazi Germany. So, and in fact, those ties went so deep that the federal government placed Prescott Bush's Union Banking Corporation under the Trading with the Enemies Act and seized all the assets. So that's kind of a hidden little aspect of the Bush family history that not many people talk about. Now, there is a connection that is not mentioned very much concerning George Herbert Walker Bush, and that is that during the 1988 presidential campaign, Democratic Party operatives uncovered the fact that many of the emigre liberation movements in this country, Lithuanian, Belarusian, Estonian, and so on, were actually historically connected to that German military intelligence unit that we took over as our operational Soviet desk in 1947 under General Reinhard Gehlen. So there are all sorts of little detailed connections in the family history.
Okay.
Thanks, Steve. We appreciate that call, and we're going to take our final break of the night, and then we'll come back with as many of your questions for Joseph Farrell as we can fit in. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. We have a few minutes left with our guest, Joseph Farrell, talking about Nazis and UFOs and JFK and all kinds of stuff. We're going to go to our West of the Rockies line, Pat in Sacramento. Good morning, Pat.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering, wasn't it also true that Joseph Kennedy was accused of being a Nazi sympathizer, and wasn't he not the ambassador to Germany?
He was accused of being a sympathizer. He was certainly an appeaser to a certain extent. He didn't think that America had any business really in opposing the Nazi regime, but he was actually the ambassador to the court of St. James in Great Britain.
Well, I was wondering, are we surrounded by people in government, since there's not much difference between socialism and communism, are we not just surrounded by these people, and the party differences really don't seem to matter anymore?
Well, in my opinion, it certainly looks that way.
I think so, too. I mean, I remember my father telling me this when I was a little girl, that he had seen the papers of Germany's inventions of anti-gravity machines and their experiments with little creatures. Mm. And it makes me wonder how advanced that's become in all these years.
Well, again, yeah, I think, you know, given the fact that it's been 60 years since the end of the war, we really have to stop and consider that this technology has probably been progressed by whoever does possess it to a pretty incredible degree.
It makes it seem like everything from now on is irrelevant.
Yeah, in a certain sense, yes.
Yeah.
Let's not give up, though, Pat. Thanks for the call.
We can't.
Thanks for the call. We're going to go to our wild card line, Sierra in Texas. A lot of calls from Texas tonight. What's going on, Sierra?
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. I have a quick question. I read your book cover to cover. I really enjoy it, The Reich of the Black Swan. And a quick question. I had heard a legend where the German U-boats had went up the Mississippi River sometime in 43 or 44. And there was a story where they would stay away from shore and, observe, like, the coastal communities, and they would go on shore at early in the morning and go drink and party with the locals and in just, like, regular clothing, and they go back to their boats. And there's other legends of some of them finding their identification washing up in the water and things like that.
Well, I've never heard of that, but it is true that, especially after America's entry into the war officially, the Germans ran U-boats very, very close to the eastern and Gulf coastlines of the country, and oftentimes put commando teams and teams of spies ashore by using U-boats. So, you know, it's anybody's guess. I would find it rather difficult, though, that the Germans would have ran U-boats up the river. They certainly would have been too valuable as military pieces of equipment to risk in operations like that.
Through there, yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I was just curious about that. I really appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thanks, Sierra. We're going to go to our first-time caller line, Tom, in Southern Cal. Good morning.
Hi, George and Joseph. I have a little story of something that happened to me back when I was in the military, and it would have happened in the early 80s. And what had basically happened was a transient had showed up at the front gate to the military base. They tried to send the gentleman away, and he refused. He said, "I'm a special envoy for the President of the United States." Well, finally they brought him into the military police station where I happened to be doing cleaning detail. And they started questioning this gentleman to find out, you know, what he knew and, you know, who he was. And they were basically just teasing with him because they believed he was a transient. Well, one of the things that he said, "Well, I work for Jimmy Carter and he works for the Nazis." And they said, no, Jimmy Carter's not even the president anymore. Okay. He was the last president we had. Well, they kept quizzing this gentleman. And finally, after a period of time, he got really upset with them. And he turned around and he says, "I know you all don't believe me." So he says, "Call this number and say this word." And so they thought, well, what the heck? You know, we questioned the guy for about 30 minutes or so. They called that number, which happened to be, I believe it was the Secret Service in Denver. And they said this name. Well, the immediate response was, "Is he there now?" And they said, "Yes." And he says, "Okay, don't talk to him. Isolate him. We're on our way."
Huh.
And about 30 minutes later, a helicopter landed out front. They took the gentleman, loaded him onto the helicopter, and left. And it has always bugged me because, you know, here these guys quizzed him up and down thinking, okay, you know, this guy's some flake or something. And what he was basically saying was he worked for Jimmy Carter, who was no longer the president. He was the president prior. I forget who came after him. And that he worked for the neo-Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Wow, there's a lot of people who don't like Jimmy Carter for a variety of reasons, but him being a Nazi is not one I've ever heard of. I can imagine I can imagine them coming to get this guy because he'd been telling this story around. Maybe they perceived him as a threat to Jimmy Carter, who would still have Secret Service protection.
It could be. It could be. I mean, but it's always bugged me because I never perceived that either. I'm like, well, now, wait a minute. You know, Jimmy Carter involved with it. I just didn't see that.
Right.
But, like I said, it has always bugged me, and I'm just glad to, you know, tell somebody about it, because for years I kept thinking, okay, who really does run this government?
Well, I have to go with George on this one. I think probably they just perceived him as a threat and probably carted him off just out of protection of the president.
David, thanks.
It could have been. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We're going to go to our wild card line, Steve in Costa Mesa, California. What's on your mind this morning?
Hi, George. Hi, Joe. Hey, thanks for a great show. Hey, I just wanted to ask about the possibility of a faster-than-light drive if they develop any of these technologies. And do you think it could exist in this universe and, you know, with all the paradoxes and it implies time travel? And
oh, boy, that's a big can of
stuff.
There have been experiments recently in physics with photon entanglement, and in Germany, as a matter of fact, they've been successful in transferring entire movements of Mozart symphonies at faster-than-light velocities. So the technology and the experimental evidence exists that this is a possibility. as to whether anybody has developed any sort of drive like that. It would require a rewriting of a lot of physics to do that.
Yeah, so, that's what I was thinking.
Right.
Well, thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. We've got on our wild card line, we've got Bob in Illinois. It's got to be pretty late there. Bob, what's going on?
Hey, how's it going tonight? I know that you're pushed for time, and I understand that. I just wanted to try to tie this up very quickly. I think it's very important that we understand that what we're dealing with here is a threshold that's very dangerous. It's been understood from the very beginning of time in Genesis when it's talked about, it mentions that the serpent was more crafty or more smarter than any of the other animals. The true Hebrew translation in English, the best job done is for the serpent is nechash or nahash in Hebrew, which means fiery serpent or cherub or carob. Mm-hmm. The true understanding in Hebrew of a cherub was he that has no form, but from out of which form is made. Mm-hmm. The Hebrews, the true Hebrews believe that when God spoke the world into existence, when he spoke the trees, he spoke the people, the fish, etc., he spoke, and from this cherub, this class of angelic being, his job was to, as God spoke, his voice, his raw power was focused through this angel. And
hey, Bob, I'm going to have to ask you to come back to the topic that we're talking about. Can you get close to a question
exactly.
here?
Absolutely. I was going to tie it in by saying that as fiery being, it's considered, that angel is considered to be energy. And what Einstein, what Tesla, what all the scientists of that era, and most importantly, the Manhattan Project understood and finally unlocked was that everything that we consider reality, everything that we consider substance, is nothing but true, pure form of energy. In other words, what we see as matter around us is nothing but illusion, that gravity, that magnetism, and energy form the reality around us. What they actually learned to do is to unlock the illusion of reality around us, and that's where the danger therein lies, and is that all of this ends up becoming a potential tool to unlock the very fabric of reality.
Okay, let's tackle that so far. You know, there is some discussion, and I've read papers about it recently, about how we might all exist in some sort of virtual reality, or we're a dream of some super being. Any thoughts, Joseph?
Well, there is actually a model in contemporary theoretical physics that talks about the holographic properties of the universe. And as far as the physics of what he's getting into there, I really don't talk about that aspect of things so much in the two Nazi books. I delve into it to a great extent in my three books on the Great Pyramid. So he is correct in a certain sense that there's an aspect of this physics that implies consciousness and manipulation of it.
Okay, thanks, Bob. We're going to go to William in Wichita, Kansas. He's on our wild card line. William, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, I'll be as quick as possible as well. Thank you for letting me be on the show. It's great. I have a question and a comment. The first question is, does the Philadelphia experiment have anything to do with this here?
With this? Well, it's interesting that you mention that because I've written a sequel to SS Brotherhood of the Bell. It's at the publisher, and it also involves the Philadelphia experiment. There are aspects of the physics behind both that are connected, yes.
Oh, I see. That's wonderful. My grandfather and my uncle were both SS soldiers in the German army, and I've came upon some really interesting things in time and history, and especially what the gentleman was talking about. I'm the fire snake depicted in the Chinese zodiac, and there's a lot of mysterious and paranormal things that have been happening to me lately.
Well, you're going to have to maybe send us an email and tell us a little bit about that. Thanks for the call. We have got Walter east of the Rockies. You're calling us from Massachusetts. Better make it a fast question. We got two or three minutes left.
Yeah, on Alex Jones' website, there's a picture of Bush Jr., the president, doing a Heil Hitler salute. I want to know what do you think about that?
I really wouldn't know what to think. I'm not familiar with what you're talking about, so I really can't comment.
Looking at it, well, it's the obvious, all the evidence that points to what they're doing.
Well, I'd have to guess he wouldn't want to be caught and photographed giving that salute, but
yeah.
but yeah, it does give you pause to ask questions. We've also got our west of the Rockies line, Philip in Sacramento. We can try to squeeze you in here.
Hello.
Hello. What's your question?
Yeah, my question was, when I was listening earlier, you mentioned the brother, the bringer of light, and in the Hitler speeches, New World Order. How does that figure into, do you think, for the Brothers of Illuminati?
Well, to a certain extent, the Nazi Party was, of course, midwifed into existence by several secret societies in Nazi Germany. And, you know, once you get involved in that aspect of the history, it goes pretty much everywhere. And there probably are little connections with the Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati, and so on.
Yeah, it seems like I remember in the book you mentioned these secret societies in Germany in the 1920s working on some of this stuff, right?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely.
Philip, anything else there real quick?
That's all I needed. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much. I think we're just about out of time here. I'm wondering, Joseph, if anybody has ever approached you about producing documentaries or videos based on your work.
No, not yet. It's something that really hasn't happened yet, but I suppose eventually it will.
Yeah, because it seemed like it would be a natural.
Right.
It's a lot of stuff to get your mind around.
Oh, yes, it is.
And so your next book is called what?
The book that just came out is called The Cosmic War, and it's subtitled Interplanetary Warfare, Modern Physics and Ancient Texts. And then there's another book that's at the publisher right now that is kind of a sequel to SS Brotherhood of the Bell. Unfortunately, I can't give out the title because we don't know what the title is yet. So.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me it's some big, dark Nazi secret or something.
No.
Anything else to say? You got about 30 seconds. Anything else our listening audience should understand about all this stuff, because it's pretty depressing if it's all true.
Well, the only thing I would say is if they want to order the books, it's the number is 1-800-718-4514, or they can get online at www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com. They're all $16.95 each. There's a 10% discount on three or more books.
Okay. Joseph Farrell, it's been fascinating. Thanks very much. Of course, our listeners can also – thanks. Our listeners can also contact him through the Coast to Coast website. I'm George Knapp. It's been a pleasure, and I'll see you back here in a couple of weeks or so. Thanks to the production staff and all the folks who helped make this program possible, Coast to Coast AM. We'll talk to you next time.